Meeting will come to order. This is the first meeting of the Capital Investment Conference Committee, and though often the first meeting is a laborious reading of the side-by-side, those of you who know me know that I don't like exercises in futility, and I think everybody in the audience knows the language that pertains to them and the numbers that pertain to them, so we're not going to be doing that. And we're going to go directly into some language. Kathy Cardell is here and has only a limited amount of time, and so we're going to start with her. MMB brought an amendment to us in committee as our bill started going through the process, but I think the Senate conferees have not had an opportunity to hear that amendment and the rationale for the different pieces. So if we could just have an explanation of those parts of the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathy Cardell, Assistant Commissioner, MMB for Treasury and Debt Management. And what I'm going to do, and I'm very relieved that you did not have a different side-by-side than the one that I've marked up and highlighted, is try to point you to, as Chair Houseman indicated, some language that was included in the House bill that was at the request of MMB, primarily having to do with, Build America bonds and such forth, but we'll get to that in a second. Let's start with the very first page, R1. On the House side, lines 1.30 to 2.3, there is a sentence in there that says, unless otherwise specified, state agencies or officials may spend a portion of an appropriation under this article to pay for the capital costs of staff directly attributable to the capital project or projects funded by the appropriation, consistent with policies adopted by MMB. And just a little bit of context and background for some of you. This is a bond council request that we include this in the bill. It arose out of findings from the December 2008 legislative audit of the GO bond program. Some of you, I'm sure all of you, but certainly some of you are aware that in the past, some agencies have previously received specific authority to expend bond proceeds for program delivery or project management costs. Examples of that are MnDOT in the 2008 Chapter 152, the big transportation bill. Bowser is another agency that has kind of routinely received that sort of authority. The OLA audit found that there were some agencies that were using bond proceeds in that manner for staff costs, but without any of the specific authority. They recommended in their findings that MMB develop a policy to address that, because using staff or charging staff costs to GO bond proceeds for those individuals who are performing work that is directly related to delivering that capital project is a perfectly permissible use of those funds. The issue is that we need to be able to very specifically track those people's time to individual projects. And so we met with agencies over the summer of 2009, formalized a policy in October of 2009, and this language provides the necessary authority for the appropriations in the bill to be used for this purpose unless you specifically decide you don't want a particular program or project to have it. And I will just say that in our meeting, after we had our side-by-side review with bond counsel, the Attorney General's office, House and Senate staff and counsel, Wednesday afternoon of last week, and after that meeting, Mr. Watson came up with some alternative language which will accomplish the same thing. So we're fine with either one. And if you want, I'll stop there and you can ask me any questions.
Senator Tomasoni.
Madam Chair. Ms. Cardell, you said it's perfectly appropriate to use the money from the bonds in this particular manner. Is it necessary then to have the language?
Madam Chair and Senator Tomasoni, it is, because in the bonding bill we deal with the issue of specificity, and the reason that bond counsel suggested that we want to have some language like this in here, just as we say to pre-design, design, acquire land, you know, do environmental work or engineering, all of those things. And because you have in the past authorized specific use of funds for these purposes, they felt that it should be included as well in the bill.
So, Madam Chair,
Senator,
in the past, did we actually say it, or was it just assumed that it was appropriate?
Madam Chair and Senator, in the past, where at least the instances, and again, my history here is somewhat limited, but in 2008, in Chapter 152, the Transportation Bill, where trunk highway bonding, the $1.8 billion of trunk highway funding was authorized, or bonding was authorized, there were specific language and amounts identified in that bill that was to be able to be used for, I think in MnDOT's case, they call it program delivery. I think in the Bowser case, the language, it's a percentage. I think it should be in there. Bond Council feels strongly about it.
And Ms. Cardell, isn't part of the purpose, once we state it, then you monitor and provide oversight and report?
That's, Madam Chair, that is correct, and that gets me to the next piece of related to this first sentence of language, which is on page R95. It's line 64.31 to 65.4. In our policy document, we indicated that we were going to require agencies that were going to use bond proceeds in this matter to specifically identify the legal citation, to give us an estimated amount, and describe for us their methodology for how they were going to track this and report it to MMB. And as a leading up to this next language, this was an amendment that was offered by Representative Solberg. I think it was in Ways and Means. I might not be getting that right, but I think it was Ways and Means. That basically then we'll add on a requirement for us to take that information that we will presumably be accumulating going forward and report back to you, to chairs of the various finance, Ways and Means committees, and so forth.
So, though it has been done, it hasn't been
tracked or reported. That's correct.
Representative Colbert.
Madam Chair, and I think Council or others have said that we probably need to put a date in it. So, I think they're just going to put a date in when the report's due. That's okay.
Okay. Somebody making note of that?
The date. The date of the report.
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, the modification would be to make a specific date instead of just generally annually. I think we were looking at January 15th as a good time for legislators to get the information.
Madam Chair, one more question.
Senator Tomasoni.
Madam Chair, Ms. Cardell, this is a departure from what you have suggested in the past to do. In the policy regarding the use of general obligation bond proceeds to fund staff costs. It says state agencies are strongly encouraged to charge the time of state employees working on capital projects to non-bonding funding sources because of undesirable practice of amortizing such salary costs over a 20-year life of general obligation bonds. Is this because of the condition of the economy and the budget that you don't want to change that policy, or?
Ms. Cardell.
Madam Chair and Senator Tomasoni, MMB did not have a policy other than to discourage people from using bond proceeds in this manner. I think we would say we would still, as we expressed in the policy, prefer that agencies not use bond proceeds to pay their staff costs. However, some of them are. And we feel like if they're going to do that, then we want to be able to have a mechanism in place to know how much they're spending and on what.
And Ms. Cardell, I think isn't the added piece, some of them are, and the Office of the Legislative Auditor took a look at that.
That's correct.
And
issue, and really, Madam Chair and Senator, the issue was that that some of these agencies were looking at a project, let's say, and saying, well, for this project, we're going to charge 5% for our staff costs for administering that project, which is contrary to what tax law says, federal tax law, which is that we must be able to specifically tie the cost to a project. And just assigning flat percentages to a project or a group of projects was not sufficient for that purpose.
Further? Okay, continue.
The next set of changes are on R96. They start at the very top under on line 65.16. And again, I'll give you a little context.
Ms. Cardell, are you going back later to 6413 to 6423? Are you going to deal with that later? Because that was added in one of the amendments as well.
Oh, Madam Chair, I apologize. I missed that one with my highlighter there yesterday. I can certainly do that. Let's go back to 6413 to 15, basically, with the adoption by MMB of the new capital investment guidelines, which guidelines are much more of a point-in-time calculation rather than an attempt to extrapolate what our position will be in the next 6 years. We are suggesting that we would amend the statute to require us to prepare the debt capacity calculation, and it only is part of the November forecast, and not do it twice. It allows both the governor's office and the legislature to work from the same set of numbers. They're not going to get changed then sometime in March when the second forecast is released. Just from our perspective, we were questioning what the value would be of doing that forecast twice.
And I think you talked about a point in time.
Yes.
And is there any value in having 2 points in time instead of a point in time by which we use that information?
Madam Chair, I think that one of our objectives in the new capital investment guidelines was to have it be not as volatile by utilizing the personal income information as sort of the denominator. So I think that while we certainly could continue to do it twice, I think that it's very likely that there would not be a lot of difference from one time to the next, from November to February.
Questions? Okay, continue.
Now on to R96. These are provisions that largely relate to something you probably have heard about but may not have a lot of knowledge on, which are so-called Build America bonds. Build America bonds are taxable alternative to traditional tax-exempt bonds, whereby a bond issuer has the choice to either sell tax credit bonds, and to date no one has made that selection, or received a direct subsidy payment from the U.S. Treasury for 35% of the taxable interest due on the bonds. This is a program that was authorized in the Federal Recovery Act last year. We did secure some broad authority in 2009. It was in the, as I like to call it, the non-controversial tax bill, to allow the state to issue general obligation bonds as Build America bonds, but that was really before there had even been very much guidance from the federal government and the Treasury as to how the program was to be implemented. It was initially only intended to be available until the end of calendar year 2010, this year. But it is now proposed by both the administration and the Congress to be made permanent. If they had not been pursuing that course, we would not be requesting these changes, quite frankly. So what we see on subdivision, or I should say on line 6516 on R96, is some authority for us to also use our Build America bond structure in conjunction with the previously authorized 911 revenue bonds that are sold to finance the public safety MnDOT program for backbone for emergency communications throughout the state. We don't know whether it will be attractive from a financial perspective or not, but it would be useful to have that as a potential alternative that we could look at and see if it is more cost-effective for us to do 911 bonds as Build America bonds. The next set of additions are on line 6524 through 6531. This language is in here because we need to be able to compensate underwriters for selling any Build America bonds that we might issue. And again, for those of you that maybe are not that familiar with the state's debt issuance practices, when we sell tax-exempt general obligation bonds, we sell them at a price of what is called par, which is 100% of the face value plus a premium. And we take a portion of that premium, and that is used to compensate the underwriting firms that are selling our bonds to the ultimate investors. The taxable Build America bond structure does not permit that. And so any BABs that we would issue have to be sold at par. And the effect of that is that if we then netted out from that kind of poor amount of bonds, the underwriter's compensation, we would not have sufficient funds for the projects because that would cut into the projects. So this language is really allowing us to issue a small incremental additional amount above the amount that you've authorized for the projects, not to exceed 2%, and use that funding to pay underwriter compensation. And you'll note we've tried to put more limitations around it. We would only look at doing Build America bonds if, in fact, there was a net present value savings to the state compared to using traditional tax-exempt bonds. And it also cannot result in an increase in the general fund debt service transfer during the biennium. Several issuers, many states have already sold these securities and found it to be more cost-effective than tax-exempt bonds, traditional tax-exempt bonds. Here in Minnesota, the University of Minnesota, I think, has done a couple series of Build America bonds. St. Paul has, many others have, and it's just a matter of evaluating the costs at the time you're getting ready to sell tax-exempt versus Build America bonds with the interest subsidy payment. Questions? Okay. And I think my last items are on that same page, down on line 66.6. You'll see the very first underlined item says "and 13. That little tiny change is intended to give the state authority to sell crossover refunding bonds. It's a type of refunding bond structure that other state agencies and all of the local governments in Minnesota already have the ability to do. I don't know that you want me to try to explain to you crossover refunding bonds, but it was something that I was surprised we didn't have the authority to do when I started in this position, and so we're trying to give us, again, one more tool to hopefully try to save the state some money down the line. And then continuing on, you'll see the language there. Bids for the securities to be purchased for the escrow account may be secured at the commissioner's election, either through the State Board of Investment or a suitable financial institution. There is nothing in statute currently that really tells us what we're supposed to do when we need to purchase open market treasury securities for a refunding escrow account. And the purpose of this language is to clarify that we can either use the staff at the State Board of Investment to conduct that competitive bid process. We are required to do that competitively, and we have to get at least three bids. Or that we could use another financial institution, a bank like a U.S. bank or a Wells Fargo, or other institutions that have broker-dealer capacity like a RBC Capital Markets or Piper Jaffray, someone like that. And so we discussed that with the State Board of Investment. They were fine. And I think that's the end of it.
You see why I wanted her to come forward and explain this language that we added that wasn't in the Senate bill. I shuddered to think if I had to explain the.
You don't want me explaining crossover refunding bonds. Okay. We'll need a picture.
Any questions about does that complete all of yours? And on that last one, by the way, those lines 66, 7, 8. State Board of Investment has signed off on that, and all of your language, I think you indicated, Bond Counsel, Attorney General's Office, everyone who needs to have
correct.
taken a look at it. Or
that's correct.
Any further questions? Because she is leaving and won't.
I'm a babysitter today.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, everyone.
I'm sorry. Ms. Dyson has a.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to point out that among the provisions that the.
You want to grab your.
Sorry about that. Madam Chair, I just wanted to point out for the members that the House had the language that the department requested, but we accidentally left off the amendment of one section of statute. So it's not in the House bill, but it is referenced in the provision that she just described. And so I wanted to point out that if the department's request is included, there would be one other section relating to the 911 bonds that is already cross-referenced with what she described, but that section was accidentally omitted.
So if any of you wondered what she was talking about and didn't see it in the language, that's the reason. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair.
Today we did want to talk about a few areas of language. Page 50. I wanted to talk just briefly about Moose Lake, since that was an issue that came on both the House and the Senate floor. And what is it? R74. R73. And the Senate added $1 million for design of a facility at Moose Lake. The House brought forward the governor's initiative in its entirety with the language accompanying that, and then also on the House floor was adopted a ward amendment that you see in lines 50.6 to 50.24. That language calls for study of existing vacant space. There was further discussion on the House floor that motivated one of our members to provide still one additional amendment, and if we could just hand that out, just so that you know, because that issue came before us simply on the Senate and House floor, another potential way to approach this, and this is language drafted by Representative Paymar, and would ask the Commissioners of Human Services, Corrections, and Administration certainly to reflect the study in the ward amendment, but more specifically, analyze the feasibility, time required, cost of making the building and infrastructure changes necessary. The study must also examine the current civil commitment policies of the state, sex offender treatment, and possible legislation to change determinate sentencing for sex offenders. The study and report must include a review of how other states use civil commitment for sex offenders. And then they ask for that for the commissioners, those three commissioners, to submit a report with specific recommendation to Capital Investment, Human Services, Policy and Finance, and Public Safety by January 15, 2011. So sort of because that issue came to the fore on the floor of both the House and the Senate and additional language was added in an amendment, Representative Paymar, who has had a long interest in this, drafted yet one additional alternative that we wanted at least to put before you. We have two other areas where I think a group of people are looking at language. One of those is in the area of transit, because that is a whole different direction. We used to fund one corridor at a time, and it was clearly spelled out. And last year, for the first time, we moved in a different direction with a pot of money that allowed the Metropolitan Council to plan and move ahead with a system that we started struggling with what language authorizes that and is the right kind of language that sets priorities, that makes it clear what the system will look like. And so this year you again have the House and Senate language that you have before you, but I think there are three senators who are working on on a slightly different approach. Senator Pappas was, I think, going to present that, and I should tell you that the two conferees who are missing, Senator Pappas is at a town hall meeting, and Representative Howes is ill and just simply was not able to make it back today. So whether she gets here before we recess, unless somebody else was prepared to speak to Senator Pappas's language, we'll have to wait for her. And I haven't had a chance to talk with him, but I was told that Senator Skoy was bringing language to the committee. Not ready?
Madam Chair, we're working on the language.
Okay.
I've talked to Representative Eakin and Representative Marquardt and Ms. Dyson, and we're working on some language.
And the issue there for the audience and others, again, it came about because of an amendment on the House floor. As we addressed the section in flood mitigation, the downriver cities have some issues of concern. What happens when Fargo-Moorhead or the Army Corps has a particular plan for that part of the Red River Valley? What happens to the cities downstream? And on the House floor, House members will recall that Representative Eakin added an amendment that said that that had to be dealt with before other money was expended. Representative Marquardt stood at the time, and they had a little bit of an exchange there. The spirit of that could be agreed to, and perhaps the language was not quite right. And so, and I think they've involved Senator Skoy as well in the drafting of that language. But that is not yet ready, I think.
Madam
yes.
Chair, of course,
Senator Langston.
I was at a meeting in Moorhead just yesterday morning, and this issue was brought up too. The very things that Representative Eakin said had to be done are being done, and that bypass channel, is going to take, I would say, at the bare minimum 6 years and possibly 10 years. And I think everybody involved thinks that by that time there will be enough of the water impound areas in place so it'll mitigate the problem up north. And everybody's on board with that. So I'm not sure we need the language, but I have agreed that we would put language in there that would indicate that would be the case.
And we'd certainly invite you, Senator Skoy, if you wanted to speak to it, you could, unless you want to wait for the language. Senator Corn.
Madam Chair, thank you. Can I talk about the amendment that was added on the House floor about the sexual offender, the ward amendment?
Yes.
And I guess
what
just
is it again? R-74.
Is it R-74 50.6? 50.8 to 50.24. Okay. Madam Chair, mm-hmm. I was under the impression that this amendment was saying that if we wanted to, well, let me back up a little bit. In the governor's bill, the department requested $5 million for demolition of some of the buildings in Brainerd. This is not saying that we can't demolish those buildings. Is that correct? Or
this makes no judgment about that.
Okay.
It was offered by Representative Ward, and I think he has an interest in those facilities, but he made the amendment broader than that.
All right. So we're not tying our hands in Brainerd, saying that no, you can't demolish those buildings and reuse that land.
Right. We are making no judgment on that issue.
Good. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So this is not.
Madam Chair, I know one of the issues that's before us is a sex offender treatment center facility, and to get a little bit better handle on it, I wonder if I think the commissioner of that program is in the audience. I wonder if
Dennis Benson is here.
Benson, could we have him approach?
Representative Solberg.
Well, Madam Chair, the proposal that's before us is on the House side is $89 million. and the Senate's got it in for $1 million, I understand, a placeholder. But there's also some additional language that's been proposed that I'm extremely interested in. And I know we have available up there right at the present time the completion of the bed section. My question is a couple of things. Your reaction to the proposed language and or any kind of a possibility of being able to phase anything that would make more sense to us in the long run on this program. And then a third one is to see where there are, if you have any additional bed space, other places. I'm thinking St. Peter or that type of thing.
Mr. Benson.
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, I'm Dennis Benson, the Executive Director of the Sex Offender Program at Moose Lake in St. Peter. We are aware of the language. I can tell you that there are pieces of the language that make some sense in terms of continuing to explore policy issues around civil commitment. I think that should be an ongoing discussion and dialogue that the legislature continues for many, many years. I don't think that we're there yet in terms of managing this population. I can tell you that we just got done going from three sites to two sites. We were renting beds over at the Moose Lake Prison at Moose Lake, and that drove our costs up dramatically. So one of the pressures, obviously, of this program and considerations is per diem. We were over $400 a day when we were renting beds from the prison. We only have a population today of 552. We are projecting growth to the tune of about 60 to 65 a year for the next 6 years. But nonetheless, we're talking about under 1,000 people, and to consider a third site, you're going to pay for this bonding package 10 times over in operational costs if you have to duplicate the infrastructure at a third site. I can also tell you that in my previous life as Deputy Commissioner of Corrections, I fell victim a couple of times to trying to renovate old DHS facilities into something that made sense for corrections, and we spent an exorbitant amount of money. And ultimately, as you know, at the end of the day, we ended up turning Faribault into a rock pile and building a real prison down there. And if corrections...
Madam Chair.
Representative Solberg.
I know that there may be some question on that, but the language of that is a study of that, and all that will come out in a study. It doesn't say you have to do it. I'm more concerned about the $89 million that's requested right now and how that might be done in a more cost-effective way and how it can be scaled in such a way. The other things that you're talking about is the cost effective of study and so forth, of changing, and there's a whole mix of things in that. The language, I guess, is, you know, is the study of the current civil commitment is important, but I'm really more interested, I think, in how we might address the problem we have right now in a more cost effective way, and can it be scaled, and can it be staged in some way.
Mr. Benson.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Holberg, and members, I don't think that this is new news to anybody that we were anticipating needing additional beds and infrastructure. We've been talking about the need for infrastructure, excuse me, long before I came. I think that was in the original proposal back in 2006 when the first building was bonded. We built, or we added 400 beds and one treatment room. So we are in dire need of additional treatment space. We are anticipating, as I mentioned, continued growth. We don't have the luxury anymore of phasing this. We talked about phasing 2 years ago. We talked about trying to get a piece of this a year ago, and today we're really painted into a corner. I understand that $89 million is a huge, huge chunk. We're absolutely, we must have the infrastructure. We don't have treatment space. We have a kitchen that was designed for 100. We have vocational workspace that was designed for 100 to 150. Our maintenance crew doesn't have the infrastructure space to manage a facility that's growing like this. So the infrastructure is $61 million. That is an absolute, in my mind, a must-have. I think we are also beginning to become more and more vulnerable to the scrutiny of the courts in terms of how we're managing this growing population in the infrastructure that was designed for 100. So that is a concern. Now, do we need all 400 beds the day that it opens? I think we'd all agree that we don't. But the reality is the projections suggest that we are going to need those beds. I think policy discussions should continue. But even if we make significant policy changes, there are 1,600 sex offenders, I believe, that are over in the Department of Corrections that are kind of in the pipeline. We know that there are 300 on the waiting list for the joint program at the Moose Lake Prison that sort of have civil commitment tattooed on their forehead if they don't get treatment, and they're certainly going to be considered by the courts. So we know that there's going to be continued growth. We were asked a year ago to look at what the cost of these five units were. We still have those numbers. We can certainly share those with you, but I need to tell you that we're supporting the $89 million. That's the governor's request. If we built two units, we could save $11 million. But then we'd have to come back and build those units. It would cost us several million additional in inflation. So, again, if we were going to look at this in some manner other than a complete package, it would have to be looking at the beds end of it, because I just can't see anything in that infrastructure that could go. We were a year ago talking about $96 million because of costs, and we did the governor's office asked us to really scrutinize our blueprint. We were able to shave a few thousand feet off of the design, and we were able to get it down to $89 million. But that's about as good as we can do.
Representative Guinness.
Thank you. You said that, if I understood correct, you have $61 million in infrastructure. It's just basic. Am I correct?
Madam Chair and Representative Wagenius, 61.
That's what I thought I heard. Could you break that into two pieces for us? Which part is treatment and which part is bed space? What's for treatment currently and what's for growth, essentially?
Treatment versus growth. Mr. Benson.
Madam Chair, Representative Wagenius, I don't have that breakdown in front of me. We could do some analysis with the architects and try to get that for you. I can tell you that you get to a point where it becomes, you know, kind of a fine line in terms of what you're establishing for the existing population and what we need into the for future growth. We do know that again, currently we have about, I think it's 11 treatment rooms. We have gutted all of the lounge areas in the units, turned those into treatment rooms. All of the clinical space, office space in the units is now treatment rooms. So we have about 12 or 13 rooms that are makeshift treatment areas now. But we'll have to dissect that $61 million and get that information for you.
Representative Ganius?
Well, perhaps it would be helpful for those of us who don't sit on corrections if you could tell us how many treatment rooms.
It's DHS.
I mean, yeah, I'm sorry, DHS. How many, don't sit on that either. How many treatment rooms that you are anticipating getting within this $61
million? Madam Chair.
Benson.
And Representative Wagenius, it's approximately 50 treatment rooms. Treatment groups are about 8 to 12 each. That's what best practices suggest works best for this population. And ultimately, that would be designed for a population of 950.
Senator Coring?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm glad we're having this discussion because it's obviously a real, real important one. And I want to just kind of put to bed one other question that's been bantered about here. The private facility, Mr. Benson, that's in, is it Appleton?
Yes.
That is my understanding that is closed or is closing. You know, I've heard people say, well, why don't we buy that facility and move the prisoners or Department of Corrections prisoners from Moose Lake over there, and then we can have the whole facility up at Moose Lake for the sex offender program. Can you just address that so that we can put that to bed, too?
Mr. Benson.
Madam Chair and Senator Coring, we had this discussion to some degree last year. It was a proposal. Certainly corrections can weigh in on this, too. I can tell you that we did rent two buildings from corrections for, I believe, 4 years as we were waiting for phase one or the first 400 building to be constructed. And there's an incredible shortage of treatment space there. At that facility, they aren't designed to treat pretty much 90 to 100% of the folks that reside there. The rooms and the units are designed in such a way that require more staff. In fact, when we moved out of there, I think most of you heard that we reduced our staff complement by 210. That was the result of more and more efficiencies. And again, it's an older facility, and to go even a quarter of a mile, we're talking about duplicating more infrastructure. And it might save us a dime today, but over the next 10 years, we are going to pay a price for that in terms of per diem operational costs. The rooms are stacked on top of each other in some of those buildings. There just isn't adequate treatment space for our population and our program.
Thank you. I think that's all the questions. Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Benson, as I look at the A71 amendment, it seems as if part of the suggestion is that we look at current facilities and vacated facilities. And I'm wondering if you might comment on to what extent has that been already done in order that this proposal has moved forward. So that would be one question. And then secondly, further down in the amendment, it talks about the need to examine the policy behind the civil commitment structure, and to what degree has that question been addressed preceding the proposal that you're carrying forward?
Mr. Benson.
Madam Chair and Senator Lynch, I think we have done certainly our due diligence around looking at other possibilities in terms of sites and site studies. That did occur when I was still with the Department of Corrections 4 years ago, 5 years ago, when some consideration was given to moving a piece of the program up to Brainerd, and it simply was deemed that it was not cost effective. Again, for you're creating another physical plant for a very small population, over 100 miles away. and it wasn't designed to provide treatment. So again, anytime you go to a third physical plant, it's going to cost more money. And this is a lesson that I think corrections learned the hard way years ago when we went to these old DHS facilities and tried to turn them into prisons. When I became the deputy commissioner in 96, the per diem was $87 a day. After we started to add beds to existing physical plants, we got it down to about $77 a day and absorbed inflation for 12 years. I think that's a lesson that we can't ignore as we manage this population. We ought to build on to existing physical plants. We have looked at St. Peter. Again, they're old buildings. They're multi-level buildings. The perimeter structure down there leaves a lot to be desired. We had some escapes several years ago that created a fair amount of hysteria. So I think in terms of what makes the most sense from an operational perspective, if we add these 400 beds, and that's where our growth is, we're predicting that our per diem can go from 328 a day down to 250 a day. Still a lot of money, but when you compare these programs across the nation, it's a reasonable number, comparatively speaking. With respect to policy, civil commitment across America is managed very differently from state to state. There's only 20 states that have civil commitment. I would encourage the legislature to continue to have policy discussion about this population, what we could do differently without compromising public safety. But as we look at this population, we have to understand who these people are. And if you read the article in the St. Paul paper today, I think the one statistic or one number that strikes me is the average number of victims that this population has is about 16. These aren't lightweight offenders that shouldn't be taken seriously. We don't have good options for these people in terms of what happens when their prison sentence expires. There has been discussion about increasing criminal sentences for this population. I think that dialogue makes some sense, but I also think we need to be careful about that too and not make assumptions. About 5 years ago, we added a life without parole possibility for sex offenders, and we found that judges and or prosecutors, for whatever the reason, weren't using it. I think there were, I'm looking at it now, 2006 it was used once, 2007 four times, 2008 three times. So I think we have to be careful as we walk down that road about not creating another situation where we create something but the courts don't use it. And you know, I think it makes good sense to increase those sentences where it makes sense, but we ought to be having discussion with the judiciary too about, does this make sense and is this going to help with the problem? The other thing I would caution is this doesn't kick in the proposal that's on the table now, probably good proposal, but doesn't kick in, wouldn't have an impact on us for 8 years. So if we're increasing, you know, at 65 a year or 60 a year for 8 years, that's almost 500 people. So, you know, it takes a long time to turn this ship around in terms of if we're going to make policy changes like that. But I think we can learn some things from other jurisdictions. I think there are pieces of this program that deserve mindful study. The one thing that I brought up more than once or twice is the fact that we have about 100 people that have an IQ of under 70. And is there a way that we can manage these people safely under other circumstances? I'm not prepared to define what that looks like, but I think that's a piece of the program that deserves some study and some analysis as we move forward. But we're in a spot here, senators and representatives, in terms of not only growth, but the constitutionality of this program. I don't think we want the courts to come in and take over this program. The courts are watching this program very, very closely and carefully. That's very apparent to me. We are double bunking with a proposal on the table, double bunks, civilly committed sex offenders. Not too many states do that. I don't know that any others do. We're pushing the envelope in that regard. I think we can do it if we manage them right, if we understand incompatibilities, and we're cautious about the downside of double bunking sex offenders. That brings costs down. But I can tell you that Washington State went under the scrutiny of the courts for several years, their program, and they're not double bunking out there. And that one policy issue could double our cost if we aren't careful with this program. So I think we have to be very, very thoughtful about how we proceed. And I don't think we have been reckless in Minnesota. I think we have a big program, a big population, but as I look at the profiles that these 550 men present, I just can't find one that really doesn't deserve additional treatment or certainly some level of security after that prison sentence has expired. These people have been involved in sex offenses at a very young age. I think the average age that they first offended was around 18. About 70% of them, their victims, are under 13 years of age. About 85 to 90% their victims are under 18 years of age. So they are, for all practical purposes, a population that is predatory in nature in one respect or another. They're not all stranger-on-stranger sexual offenders, but they have long, long histories of offending. And this isn't, it's a very complex issue and a complex problem, and certainly I understand your consternation too, but I don't think we want to be careless, reckless, or flippant about how we're going to manage these people, and putting this problem off for another year or two or three, again, with all due respect, it puts us, the innkeepers here, in a tough, tough position, not only with respect to public safety, but with the courts. And you know, it just the record needs to reflect that.
Representative Scalzi, and then I think we'll...
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And Commissioner Benson, you have your explanation makes a lot of sense when you talk about not wanting to retrofit existing DHS buildings for corrections. I can understand that because, you know, there's security concerns and all of that involved. But to have a successful program and not have court challenges, we have a small population that will possibly grow over time of people that have successfully completed treatment, have wanted to complete treatment, and we want to get them ready for entering into the community at large. And I think that when we're looking at other uses for existing buildings, we wouldn't have to retrofit them for razor wire and things like that. We want to make sure that we would work toward this program of getting people ready to enter the community if they have successfully completed treatment.
Mr. Benson.
Madam Chair and Representative, I absolutely agree with you. And I think, again, for a program that is 552 strong, we already have two campuses, two facilities. Primary treatment, front end of treatment, occurs up at Moose Lake. It is a very secure facility. That's where our holds, those people that are just coming in, are located. It's where the treatment refusers are located. It's where the aging population is located, and all of those people, about 300 plus, that are engaged in treatment. End stages of treatment occurs at St. Peter, which is a lower level facility. About 40 to 50 of the 160 that are down there get outside the razor ribbon every day, and they have what we call campus privileges. Some of them are escorted into the community. This all occurs with ankle bracelets and or GPS. We do have a community preparation service facility down there, which is a house which is located outside the razor ribbon. There are four people in that part of the program, and that is the very last stage of our program. 2 years ago, we had nobody in that house. Today, we have four, soon to be five. So those people are, again, at the very end stage, and that community, I would submit, is probably the one community in the state of Minnesota that is willing to say, we talk to them every day, every week. We talk to the mayor, the police chief, the prosecutor, and they are used to having disadvantaged people in their neighborhood, in their community. They've had sex offenders at St. Peter for many, many years. They understand that if they're well supervised and managed, the risk is minimal. So there aren't too many locations that will embrace that reintegration part of the program. And I think we're very fortunate to have a community like St. Peter that has enough willingness to work with us and partner with us on slowly stepping into deeper water with respect to our reintegration process. And you're right, that is a crucial part of the program, and sooner or later, we don't decide who comes in, we don't decide who comes out, as you all know, the courts do. But sooner or later, I'm guessing that the courts are going to deem that somebody has reached that level, that with good and proper supervision, somebody will be considered for a provisional discharge. And again, we are trying to prepare for that day. We don't decide, but we've got to be ready. I think Minnesota has to get ready. It isn't. I don't think that this can go on forever and ever. Again, I think that the courts are watching. But on the other hand, I think we have to be very, very careful about, and the courts obviously are, about who they move into those later stages of our program.
Thank you. And there's one other issue, the governor has in his proposal some MHFA housing bonds for a foreclosure program, and it requires cash. It's a different kind. It's not geobonding. The House carried it for as long as we could until we got to Representative Solberg's committee, and he said that impact over time would be something he couldn't reconcile. But we were visited by Ms. Orr, Assistant Commissioner of MHFA, who said they took one more crack at it and wanted to be able to sort of lay out for us another approach to this, and whether we think whether it passes the test of Ways and Means Chairs. Ms. Orr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Tanya Orr from the Housing Finance Agency. As you may recall, in 2008, the legislature authorized as part of the capital bonding bill that the Housing Finance Agency could issue up to $30 million in nonprofit housing bonds. That authorization had four constraints. It was $30 million. You had a standing appropriation of $2.4 million for through 2030. It could only be used for permanent supportive housing, and the final constraint was that it was time-limited. The standing appropriation was time-limited. So that meant that if, for instance, the interest rate that we assumed for calculating the debt service exceeded the 5%, which was our assumption, that we would not be able to issue $30 million. We would have to issue something less because we only had $2.4 million each year to pay the debt service. And we couldn't use it for purposes other than permanent supportive housing. And if we didn't get projects eligible, then we had a time limit to when the appropriation was available. So if we didn't get going, we wouldn't have enough money to fund the projects. We have issued 44% of the amount authorized. That's in line with what MMB estimates typically would happen with geo bonds, where 15% would be issued the first year and 35% the second year, for a total of 50%. So we're in that same range. We've committed all of the money, so we have projects that are ready to go. We will issue the final bonds when the last couple of projects are ready to be closed. But interest rates didn't go up. In fact, they went down. And we did some calculations and determined that we could actually issue another $6 million worth of bonds for the same amount that you have already appropriated as a standing appropriation. So it's money that's already accounted for. It would not require any additional funding. If you don't do that, if we're not authorized to issue another $6 million, then we would be bound by the $30 million. And eventually, you would take some savings, because if my calculations are right, it would be about $147,000 a year that would be saved because of the $30 million cap and the favorable interest rates that we have experienced. I know that you all read the newspaper and you know about the foreclosure crisis. That was one of the uses that we had proposed that this money be used for. We also are continuing our efforts to end long-term homelessness. We have, as part of our plan, we have funded almost 2,700 housing opportunities for persons who have experienced long-term homelessness, and we already have 1,700 households who have been helped. Those are 1,700 households where at least one of the people has been on the streets for 3 years or multiple times in the last 4 years. They are now in permanent housing with the supportive services they need, and we would like to continue to make progress on that effort, and this additional $6 million would allow us to do that. It's $6 million in authority. As I said, you already have appropriated the money, so it would be no additional cost to the state.
Representative Solberg.
Madam Chair, well, I think that trying to end homelessness and the changes that are made being recommended by the governor are laudable changes, I think. But I think we need to understand the long-term implications of this. There's maybe appropriated, but there's always a cost. Someone has to pay the piper. Ms. Zowers or someone can kind of go through the because it goes out into the next year, I understand that, but maybe we can have an understanding of where we're at on that, if I could, of how much has been in the forecast and so forth. My understanding is that there's 2.4 appropriated each year, and it's counted in the housing budget in fiscal 10. Well, yeah, it is counted in the housing budget. Even though our fiscal analysts take it out, it has to be counted someplace.
Right.
So it's counted in the housing budget. In fiscal 10, because the way they manage the bonds, none of that was spent for bonding. So it was actually in the forecast, we have picked up $2.4 million, I believe. In the forecast, it's already there. But maybe Ms. Zowers, the Crin, could
Ms.
help.
Ms. Zowers?
Madam Chair and members, Ms. Orr said, they've sold approximately $13.2 million in bonds. And so for fiscal year 2010, there won't be any debt service on those bonds. So in the February 2010 forecast, what you'll see is a savings there of $2.4 million per year. And then for fiscal years 2011 and beyond, the $2.4 million will be counted at 2.4 in the forecast, since the language states up to 2.4 million per year can be used for the 30 million in bonds. Currently, the debt service on the 13.2 million as I said, zero in fiscal year 2010, and then in 2011 it's 2.284 million, and then in 12 and 13 it drops off to about 822,000 per year. And the reason for that drop is just how the maturity of the bonds has been structured. And so that's where there's the ability to increase that 30 million to 36 million in bonding, is because there's in 2012, since it drops down to the 822,000 per year, there's a significant difference there between the 2.4 million and the 822,000.
And Mr. Chair, that gives us, for the 12 and 13 fiscal years, and we have to be concerned about it. But Ms. Orr, would you then, if with this additional authority, be selling 15% of that additional authority? You have 13 available right now. If you have another six, that's 19. Do you expect to sell all 19 of that? I mean, I guess where are you, what base are you working from? Or do you expect to be another 15% of the six additional or 50% of the six?
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, I would expect that the remainder of the $30 million would be sold in the next year. Most of that money is committed to a large project, which has been in progress for a couple of years now, and we hope that it will be closed in the next year.
So if I can interrupt right there, does that take you then in 12, fiscal year 12, let's say we sold it in 11, because then it would be current in 12, would that be take you up to the 2.4?
Madam Chair, sure. Representative Solberg, it would take us close to the 2.4. It would not be quite 2.4 because the interest rate isn't what we had estimated.
But then how about going out in other years? Would that still be run at 2.4?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, Representative Solberg, my understanding is, and I didn't ask for a breakdown each year, but my understanding is that because the interest rate is less than 5%, that our calculations are that we would not need to do the $30 million. We would not need a full 2.4 when all the bonds are out. We would need less than that. And that is why we could do another $6 million with the 2.4 that was annually appropriated.
Well, Madam Chair, I just need to have some kind of understanding of what happens in 12, 13, and 14 and on. You got a little bit of flexibility in there, but if you do the 13, then that brings it up to close to 2.4. Would you then be able to, if you added six more million, is that going to just ride on the books for several years before you're able to, or do you anticipate that you can do some additional bonding with the 6 million?
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, it is our expectation that the bulk of that money would be used for foreclosure recovery efforts, and that would be an acquisition rehab that could occur rather quickly.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
You can tell members this is something that weighs heavily on us in light of what's happening in the area of homelessness and foreclosures and affordable housing, and we have struggled with it and to determine just given cash flow what we were able to do, and so we thought one more idea on the table would be helpful. Thanks so much for being with us. And then I think there's one other housing issue. Kevin Wally. By the way, members, we do, of course, have the $10 million that both House and Senate have, the $10 million for public housing. Mm-hmm. And so that's on the spreadsheet for both. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I'm Kevin Wally. I represent the Minnesota NARA, which is the Housing and Redevelopment Authorities. We have a situation that I just learned about, and we've just had some discussion with Housing Finance Agency and legislators about relating to the Montgomery Housing Redevelopment Authority. They had a 40-unit public housing facility that was destroyed by fire. And the facility is insured, but the insurance is not going to fully cover replacement. And a request which we would make to the language that is already in the bill is to include the words or replacement following the words rehabilitation on lines 57-17 in the House bill and line 60.9 in the Senate bill. And that would allow the opportunity for Montgomery to secure some gap financing to replace the 40 units that were destroyed by fire last February.
So the addition of the words or replacement.
Yes, ma'am.
Everyone understand that request? Okay. Representative Scalzi?
I just had a question. The or replacement, should it say or replacement if something burns? I mean, how do we protect it for it so that we're not just replacing something that we don't like?
Mr. Wally.
Madam Chair, Representative Scalzi actually had another version of it. It said or replacement of units destroyed by fire.
Or replacement of units destroyed by fire.
Good.
Hopefully that's not opening the door to a very large thing. But we'll
talk about that, and so
thank
we
you, Madam
appreciate
Chair, members.
Bringing that forward. Members, we have, Senator Pappas is not back yet, and we have, I know some people upstairs are working on some of the transit language, and a few people are still working on that floods language. So I think we're going to recess, and I'm sorry about the Olympics. I can tell you we can truly appreciate those of us on the House Capital Investment Committee were on a capital investment tour in Duluth and missed that best Twins game of all time this season, and so we understand what it, this is. we are sorry about that, but I think we are going to recess until 8:30. Does that seem appropriate, Senator?
Yes, that's appropriate, and we intend to finish.
Mm-hmm. We have a lot of hard work. So we will reconvene at 8:30. We'll reconvene. I'll recognize Representative Solberg for a motion.
Madam Chair, I would move that we suspend the rule 2.06 under the joint rules of the House and the Senate so that we can meet later than 12 o'clock.
Discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion carries. We heard that one in the audience.
I will keep in mind everyone who laughed at my motion.
We are. We wanted to pass that motion, and we're waiting. We're minus some staff, but we do have quorum of members. So I'll recognize Representative Solberg.
Madam Chair, I would move that we adopt the spreadsheet, and it's being copied, I understand, with the ability for the staff to make changes in the numbers of the bond sale itself.
And that members would be on the very last page of the spreadsheet, which she was feeling relatively comfortable about, but wanted the opportunity to make a slight correction if she needed to.
And Madam Chair, I think that that's important because sometimes those bond sales numbers are, as we negotiate changing numbers, that makes a little difference.
And for the audience, it's being copied as quickly as possible, and they'll be available to you as quickly as we can possibly do it. We won't read through it. We'll let you read through it for yourselves, or we can talk with you after, but any further discussion to the spreadsheet? Some are happier than others. No further discussion? We have some of the staff just coming in.
You have to say all in favor?
We have to be.
Yeah.
No.
No. Oh, yeah. I made the motion to adopt.
Everyone understands the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion carries. And that is our, unless others have any other business, that is the business for the evening. And again, the spreadsheets will be copied as
tomorrow morning. We have time.
The conference committee will reconvene at 9 in the morning to look at some language.
Did everybody hear that? They're making kind of noise.
Did everyone hear? We'll reconvene at 9 in the morning to look at some language.
Here.
Anyone?
Here.
No.
123.
Where?
We do.
123 Capitol.
And we do expect to be posting the draft report on the web later this morning.
You better announce that too.
We'll just have Peter Watson announce that for the group.
As some of you may have learned in the last year or two, the revisor's office has begun to post conference reports on the web when they're done. This is likely to be in the wee hours this morning, but if you are signed up for the listserv, there'll be an email sent out when it's posted. And otherwise, just check when you get up in the morning, and you'll probably find the report on the web. in advance of our meeting at 9.
Any further business anyone has? Meeting is adjourned.